Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Chris and Rachel, I am so glad to have your both of your expertise on board. This is a week when we undoubtedly feel history in the making, is it not, Rachel?
Certainly could be.
Could be. Okay. We'll see how this unfolds. And Chris, you're sitting tight there as we discuss this whole hour. We hope our listeners are as well, soaking up the last 24, 48 hours of news. We want to ask our listeners to join our conversation. Ask questions of Chris and Rachel. What do you think will happen from this point on? What does this official impeachment inquiry launching by Nancy Pelosi represent to you? Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Yesterday, Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, announcing a formal impeachment inquiry. This is months after she resisted calls for that inquiry from fellow Democrats. She made the move after more than 75% of House Democrats demanded action.
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law. The actions of the Trump presidency revealed the dishonorable fact of the president's betrayal of his oath of office, betrayal of our national security, and betrayal of the integrity of our elections.
Yesterday, the president didn't mince words when he was at the UN addressing reporters about the topic of impeachment. Let's listen to a few of those comments.
It's a witch hunt. I'm leading in the polls. They have no idea how they stop me. The only way they can try is through impeachment. This has never happened to a president before. There's never been a thing like this before. It's nonsense. And when you see the call, when you see the readout of the call, which I assume you'll see at some point, you'll understand. That call was perfect. It couldn't have been nicer. And even the Ukrainian government put out a statement that that was a perfect call. There was no pressure put on them whatsoever. But there was pressure put on with respect to Joe Biden. What Joe Biden did for his son, that's something they should be looking at.
Why did you block aid a week before your call with the Ukrainian president?
Because very important, I want other countries to put up money. I think it's unfair that we put up the money. Then people called me, they said, oh, let it go, and I let it go. But we paid the money. The money was paid. But very importantly, Germany, France, other countries should put up money. And that's been my complaint from the beginning.
President at the UN yesterday commenting on things not having to do with the UN in particular. Rachel Caulfield, Chris Larimer, we want to invite our listeners to tell us how you feel about this. What's likely to happen in your view? 1-866-780-9100. Rachel Caulfield, this morning the White House released a reconstructed transcript, is the word that I've seen, reconstructed transcript of the July 25th call between President Trump and the leader of Ukraine. Both of you have had a chance to look over this. Rachel, give me your reaction to, that transcript in particular.
Well, so the transcript itself, it's been reduced down to this very fundamental portion of the phone call. A lot of conversation about this particular exchange where the president of the Ukraine specifically says, you know, we're ready to buy more javelins from the United States. And then the immediate follow-up by the president is, I would like you to do us a favor, though. That there's a portion of that exchange, it gets a little muddled for a little while, but he comes back then to asking the president of the Ukraine to investigate wrongdoing by Joe Biden. And so there's a lot more in this call than what we've generally been hearing about, which is that exchange. There is a portion of the call that is specifically related to advice that the president is giving to the president of Ukraine, saying, you know, you should definitely talk to Merkel about better funding for Ukraine. There is another portion where he talks about the Mueller report specifically. And so it covers a lot of ground aside from that specific ask, but that is the portion of the call that people have really focused in on. Mm-hmm.
I think, Rachel, we have to mention the context. Ukraine here, its big neighbor, had extremely aggressive behavior. In fact, nipping off a bit of Ukraine, if I can put mm-hmm. it in so nonchalantly, which I shouldn't actually, taking part of their territory. So they have a very aggressive neighbor.
Yes.
And this is part of the context.
This is part of the context. So, Ukraine is a U.S. ally, and the U.S. has been funding support for Ukraine in fighting Russia. And so this has been an ongoing conversation, not just with the U.S., but with the EU and other allies. And so this is where this military support comes in. The U.S. Congress has allocated money for support for Ukraine. The president basically said, nope, not going to send that money. That decision was made about a week before this phone call. And then the phone call happened. Funding was held up. It restarted on September 11th. Mm-hmm. So the big question here is what happened during that period of time? Why was funding withheld? And then why was it restarted? And this whistleblower complaint that has come forward includes this particular call, and the transcript was released this morning.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer, did any other parts of the transcript leap out at you as you read it this morning?
No, I think the line that Rachel focused on, the quote from the president saying, I would like you to do us a favor, though, and then going into saying that he would like to have the attorney general call the president of the Ukraine, going on later on page 4 of the transcript talking about, you know, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, and I'm quoting here, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the attorney general would be great. I think those are going to be the key segments of the call, that, or at least the transcript of the call that's been released, because he is asking for a favor. He does mention Biden specifically. He is talking about bringing in the attorney general, asking that the attorney general and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, get involved. So all of those things, I think, are going to be what's focused on. But as Rachel suggested there, you know, there isn't the specific sort of quid pro quo for please do that, please investigate Biden or I won't give you aid. I mean, that doesn't come out in the phone call.
Except, as Rachel mentioned, if after you mention the aid, in the next breath you say, will you do me a favor?
Right.
It's implicit, right?
Right,
or
it's
could
implicit.
Could be interpreted as implicit.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, let's listen to Senator Minority Leader and Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat, of course. He says having a transcript is simply not enough. This was yesterday, before the release of the transcript.
We need the complaint. We need the complaint of the whistleblower as sent to the IG. It's nice to have the transcript. We don't even know right now if the complaint is about the transcript, in part or in whole. And without the complaint, we don't know what the IG thought was so urgent. We do not know what the whistleblower thought was so urgent. So simply to release the transcript is not going to come close to ending the need of the American public and the Congress to see what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, a lot of things, holes to be filled here. This is a rough transcript, which raises as many questions as it answers, perhaps.
It does, and I think, you know, from the Democrats' perspective, what Schumer is essentially saying is that, look, you know, the transcript's not enough to make our case, to sell our case to the public. There needs to be more clear-cut than this, because I think what, you know, the last thing that Democrats want to do is end up in a situation where they were with the Mueller report, where there was a lot of speculation that this would be the event, the item that would allow them to move forward with impeachment proceedings. And then what the Mueller report eventually came out with was pretty nuanced and ambiguous and difficult to understand at points. And so what Schumer is talking about is they need more than this. They, right, as he said, they need the specific complaint from the whistleblower as far as what other things were involved, what else was said, what else was going on, what other deals that were not in this phone call may be out there, because their ultimate goal for the Democrats is that they need to sell this. And this is not, at right now, an easy-to-understand impeachment proceeding. There are a lot of moving parts here. And so if you're going to try to sell this to the in terms of public opinion, you need to make as clear-cut a case as possible.
Okay, join our conversation. How do you feel? What do you think about what's happened this week in the last 48 hours, in particular with the launching of an official impeachment inquiry and the two narratives that we're seeing constructed here? It's a bit of a deja vu. Let's go to Troy in Iowa City. Troy dialed 1-866-780-9100. Troy, what's your question?
My question is are they going to investigate Biden? Because it looks like Biden actually tried to obstruct justice about his son for taking money from the Russians.
Okay.
When are they going to start investigating them for Hunter Biden getting millions and actually billions from China?
Okay,
Wouldn't
Troy.
Wouldn't that be a great idea to do?
Let's get a response. Let's get a response to your question, Troy in Iowa City. Rachel, what do you think of Troy's question?
Well, there have been several and several different kinds of investigations of this allegation that the Obama administration and specifically Vice President Biden, made this request to get rid of this prosecutor because his son Hunter Biden was sitting on the board of this gas company. All of those investigations have indicated that there's not any wrongdoing on the part of Joe Biden or Hunter Biden. And so basically, you know, if you look at just a chronology of this, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but there was, you know, an allegation of corruption. There was a specific prosecutor who was alleged to be corrupt. It was investigated. The IMF and the World Bank and a number of our allies had concluded that this particular prosecutor was corrupt and called for their removal. Biden did enter into the fray. He did so as a part of official Obama administration policy calling for the removal of that prosecutor. Hunter Biden was added to the board of this gas company, this Ukrainian gas company, after these allegations of corruption, as in part as a way to show that they were turning a new leaf and, putting this corruption behind them. So he was meant to kind of add some credibility to the board after this corruption episode had taken place. So, to the extent that any further investigation would be done, I suspect it would find exactly the same thing that all previous investigations have found, which is no wrongdoing on the part of Biden.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, answering your questions about the latest developments with this Ukraine controversy, the release of the transcript this morning, I should say a reconstructed. They've also used the word rough transcript. Before we pedal forward, let's pedal back a little bit. There's so much to take in. Chris, what happened this week to change the minds of so many House Democrats and Nancy Pelosi? In fact, we should mention here that Iowa's House delegation, the Democrats, accepting Steve King, of course, the only Republican in the House delegation from Iowa, the other three on board with this this inquiry. What happened, Chris?
Well, I think it was just it sort of started to build early in the week where there was the report about the whistleblower complaint that there was Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, brought up about the whistleblower complaint. There was talk about the phone call. Once those pieces started to move, you started to see some of the House Democrats start to move in favor of impeachment, including House Democrats who were from, who were considered a little bit more moderate. There was the New York Times started tracking this the other day yesterday, and you started to see just as the day went on the number of Democrats who would come over from being undecided to be actually being in favor of impeachment. And so it was a calculation on Speaker Pelosi's part that once she had, the majority, once you had a sufficient number of Democrats on board, that they felt comfortable to move forward, because that's where they're going with this, because she has obviously made a calculation that if this moves forward, that if they find enough to vote on articles of impeachment, that vote is going to pass and that it will move to the Senate. Otherwise, they would not have started this process. And so I think it was a lot of it was just building up. Their political scientists were kind of tracking some of this over the last couple of days, looking at where the Democrats were from, the type of districts they were from, as far as who was in favor of impeachment and who was undecided. And for a considerable period of time, it was those Democrats who were in what we would consider kind of the more competitive House districts that were reluctant to come over on the impeachment side. But as the day went on, we saw more and more of those moderates come over, including, as you said, you know, Congresswoman Cindy Axne from Iowa's 3rd District, Congresswoman Finkenauer from the 1st Congressional District. Those two districts are very competitive.
And were they not coming over until this week?
It was late. It was mid-afternoon yesterday that I believe both of them put out statements saying that they were in favor of moving forward with the impeachment inquiry.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is behind that for our representatives there in those districts?
Well, I think they're looking at the rest of the House Democratic Caucus, and they're looking at the what Speaker Pelosi wants to do, and again, making a political calculation that this is the best move forward, and that's where we are right now, is that both sides are making a political calculation about where this is going to go, where the public is going to go on this, and obviously Speaker Pelosi has made the calculation that if this moves forward, if the articles of impeachment are voted out of the House Judiciary Committee, if that's where it starts, that if it goes to the floor, they have enough votes to pass this and move it on to the Senate, and that by moving it on to the Senate, you're forcing a decision on the part of Republican senators.
Right, and they will have to be on the record after the investigation, after hearing all the evidence,
right.
The best case that the House Democrats can put forward with these, six committees, right?
Right.
Now coordinating with each other. Okay, let's get to our phones. There's a lot of input our listeners would like to have for good reason. Let's go first to Waterloo. Logan is in Waterloo. Welcome to the program, Logan. You're with Chris Larimer and Rachel Caulfield. Go ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to ask, what do we think that Iowa senators are going to do? I know that Grassley has this history, for some reason, of being in big support of whistleblowers. But yesterday, when he was asked about it, he kind of shrugged it off and said, I need to talk to this person. Mm. Is every member of Congress going to get to talk to this whistleblower? And if the House goes to impeachment, I'm sure the Senate is going to fight it. So what's Senator Ernst going to do?
Right.
She has been right in step with the Trump agenda since day one.
Okay, Logan, thank you very much. Very good questions there from Waterloo. Logan, one of our listeners. In fact, I have Senator Grassley's statement from his office. Let me read just the first two paragraphs of his response. Chuck Grassley's response to Nancy Pelosi's move to open this official impeachment inquiry. Speaker Pelosi announced an impeachment inquiry even before seeing the call transcript, or hearing from the alleged whistleblower or the Director of National Intelligence. That says all anyone needs to know about the legitimacy of the Democrats' impeachment inquiry. Impeach now, facts later. Continuing with the Grassley quote for another couple lines. I've read the transcript in its entirety. It shows there was no quid pro quo. The Ukrainian president admitted problems with corruption in the country and agreed that the issue at hand warranted looking into further. Rachel, tackle that in conjunction with Logan's question here. What Grassley saw, what he says he sees in the transcript, does that line up with what you saw?
Well, we're seeing, and this is a narrative that a lot of Republicans are adopting, that this is a personal vendetta against the president, and Democrats are jumping on the impeachment bandwagon before really having all the facts. I think that we have a long way to go before any potential vote by the Senate. So there will be a lot more information that comes forward if we get to that point, and I'm not sure that we will. I think Democrats have learned a few things from the original Mueller investigation that they're applying to this. They're moving very quickly. Remember that this whistleblower complaint potentially includes much more information than just this one phone call. So by pushing as hard as they are on this one phone call very early, I think they anticipate that they're going to drive a lot of attention to the whistleblower complaint more generally. So what other allegations might come forward as a result of that? It's said that the whistleblower's lawyer has been in contact with both the House and Senate intelligence committees, and they're working to potentially have the whistleblower testify in closed hearings by the end of the week. So we could be getting a lot more information very quickly. which comes to another piece of this. I think the definition of quid pro quo, which I always hate that phrase, but
say that five times fast.
Yeah, exactly. the Democrats have been very clear that it is not necessary to prove quid pro quo in order to proceed with an investigation. This is kind of the opposite of what they did during the Mueller investigation, right, where they said this is about collusion, and they tried to walk this line of saying, you know, there's going to be some criminal facts that come out of this, right, material facts that come out of this that are going to prove that the president broke the law. And they're very purposefully, I think, in this case, suggesting it is not necessary to prove an explicit offer of money for investigation, right? That's mm-hmm. not necessary to move forward with an investigation. And the Republicans then are taking exactly the opposite tack this time, right? They've switched sides on this a little bit. The Republicans are saying, no, you have to prove that this was an explicit bargain before you can move forward with any impeachment. So they've switched sides on that point. And I also think it's interesting that the Democrats are highlighting the campaign finance violation right out of the gate, right? So they're mm-hmm. saying if it's true that the president potentially offered this congressionally authorized aid, right, if he withheld this aid and then made it conditional upon an investigation by the Ukrainian government, then A, that's a potential campaign finance violation because he's accepting something of value from a foreign government. And B, it's a potential violation of the national security interests of the United States. Mm-hmm. So they're laying out those cases early on and trying to frame this discussion going forward. And by moving very quickly, I think the hope is that they will overwhelm with facts and with new information coming forward on a regular basis, rather than what they saw with the Mueller report, which was this very long, drawn out, judicious proceeding.
Right. Okay. To get to the process here, we only have about a minute left. Chris, correct me if I'm wrong. I had a flow chart that the New York Times had on its front page this morning. So it could be that these, after some time, these investigating committees, six of them in the U.S. House, get together. One possible outcome is they find no reason for impeachment, and they don't even put it to the vote, right?
Yeah, that is a possibility. Again, you wouldn't expect that to happen. You wouldn't expect Speaker Pelosi to start this process if they didn't expect to be at least have a vote that would move forward and potentially move it to the United States Senate. And I think you know Logan's point is an interesting one, because he's absolutely right that Senator Grassley has been a long supporter of whistleblower protection, of kind of the government watchdog role. On the other hand, right, he's got to make this vote. And when you think about, he mentioned Iowa's other senator, Senator Ernst, she's up for re-election in 2020. So this is going to be even a more difficult decision for her if it gets to that point.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. We'd like more of your reaction mixed in with the analysis of Chris Larimer and Rachel Caulfield, Rachel of Drake, Chris of the University of Northern Iowa. Join our conversation. We want to get as many listeners in on this conversation as possible in the next half hour. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with the analysis of Rachel Caulfield and Chris Larimer in just a moment. It's Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Back with Politics Wednesday on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University in Des Moines. She's in our Des Moines studio. And what a day it is, a day when we can, or a week rather, we can feel history being made. Only two presidents have been impeached. We had to go back into the 1800s for the first one, Andrew Johnson, and then leap into the late 20th century for the second one, Bill Clinton in 1998. Both were ultimately acquitted. Richard Nixon resigned in 1974 to avoid being impeached. Important to keep in mind here, too, the U.S. House of Representatives impeaches. It's launching an inquiry. That's the formal part of this. It has not impeached the president yet, but the Senate Later on, if the House votes for impeachment, the Senate can convict or acquit. And our experts can correct me or add to that as you would like, but I think that's a good little summary of what we have in store for us, possibly laying out some lines. Let's go to John in Centerville. He dialed 1-866-780-9100. John, what's on your mind as you listen to this discussion and soak up the news that we've been hearing the last few hours?
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for having me. Just one quick comment and one quick question. One, I really feel the Democrats are grasping at straws, and maybe that's because they don't feel they have a viable candidate for the nomination. And two, if the president is impeached this close to elections, what does that do for the Republican nominees or the Republican side of things?
Two good questions. John, a quick follow-up before we have our analysts weigh in. Why do you think that the Democrats are grasping at straws? What leads you to believe that?
Well, I just, earlier this morning I had a chance to watch another news broadcast as they were going over the transcripts from the phone call, and they went through them line by line, and there was nothing that I personally could see that where the president had acted inappropriately. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's just my opinion on that.
Good, John. Thank you very much. Let's get Chris Larimer. React to John in Centerville. What he says, grasping at straws is what the Democrats are doing.
Well, I think everybody's going to look at what's happening here through their own partisan lens. I think for a lot of people, they've made up their mind about President Trump, whether or not anything he's done up to this point, including with the conversation with the Ukrainian president, whether or not, what he's done is impeachable. And I think for most people, you only have to look at opinion polls on the president. And if you look at the daily tracking of his approval rating, it's been pretty stable since he's come into office. It's relatively low. We know that compared to previous presidents, but it's been relatively stable. You don't see a lot of fluctuation in it, and a lot of people have argued that his feelings toward him are fairly stable. And so I think at this point, people probably have their mind made up about if they are engaged in the political process, if they are somewhat partisan or strong partisans, they're going to have their mind made up about President Trump at this point. I don't think this is going to. I'd be surprised if this persuades a lot of people's minds to suddenly no longer support the president. As far as, John's second question, if it would get to the point where the Senate would convict the president with a two-thirds vote, obviously Vice President Mike Pence would take over. And then it's my understanding, and Rachel may know more on this, mm-hmm. my understanding, I think they could, if they would like to still field a different candidate for the nomination process, they could do that. But my guess is that they would probably rally around Vice President Pence at that time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but before we go to Rachel, let me have us listen to a few comments by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He made these comments on the idea of the impeachment inquiry. He's explaining how the process in the Senate would handle any articles of impeachment sent by the House.
Wait a minute. What we have here is an allegation related to Ukrainian aid by a whistleblower. That's about all we know now. The way to handle it in the Senate at this particular point is the acting head of DNI, the acting DNI, is coming up to the Intelligence Committee on Thursday. The Intelligence Committee in the Senate has a reputation for dealing with things in a responsible way and in a bipartisan way, and that's where it all starts in the Senate.
Okay. Rachel, your comment as we feel our way forward into a possible future in the Senate with this impeachment process.
Yeah, and I think I would start again with there's a lot of information we don't have yet. So in terms of are the Democrats grasping at straws, we don't know exactly how this is going to eventually come together. What Nancy Pelosi announced really is not anything new, except that the six current investigations will now be jointly under an umbrella of an impeachment inquiry. those six investigations have been going on. They will continue to go on. But I think regarding this specific line of inquiry, there are, you know, aside from this transcript, there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle that need to come together. And so, you know, I'm not sure exactly what changed for Nancy Pelosi as of yesterday. She's been saying all along that until it's a bipartisan effort, she will not pursue impeachment. It is not bipartisan, and yet something shifted that kind of encouraged her to do this. Similarly, usually when the House is going to proceed with impeachment, that's something that would be voted on by the chamber, and it was not. So she basically yesterday just announced that the six current investigations will continue under the umbrella of an impeachment inquiry. So we don't know exactly what the procedural path is going to be, in part because we don't know what the outcome of these six investigations are going to be.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. So many other things prepared to talk about, but...
It seemed a busy week already, didn't it?
Well, my many pages of unused notes do testify to that. Let me get to some of those things that have been in politics other than what's been happening with this official impeachment inquiry. Let's talk about Greta Thunberg. Speaking before the UN, some see her as courageous for telling the truth about climate change. This week, we also heard, though, critics depict her as a liar or hypocrite, suggesting her parents may have manipulated her or portrayed her as a ringleader of a socialist conspiracy. This is the 16-year-old Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg's shaming of world leaders over climate change. It's won her millions of admirers, attracted many new followers to her cause. I was just seeing a report from Reuters this morning, reports that Thunberg is the bookmaker's favorite to win the Nobel Peace Prize next month. I hadn't heard that before.
Wow.
But let's listen to her impassioned, part of her impassioned speech from this 16-year-old before the United Nations Climate Action at their summit, Climate Action Summit in New York City this week.
Science has been crystal clear. How dare you continue to look away and come here saying that you are doing enough when the politics and solutions needed are still nowhere in sight? You say you hear us and that you understand the urgency. But no matter how sad and angry I am, I do not want to believe that. Because if you really understood the situation and still kept on failing to act, then you would be evil, and that I refuse to believe.
An amazing young woman. Chris, first of all to you and then to Rachel, what do you make of this young activist and how she has shaped the climate change debate?
Well, I mean, the climate change debate, you know, has been ongoing, and we've heard, you know, there have been periodically over the last 12, 24 months, there have been these, you know, reports that have come out through the United Nations talking about the horrible long-term effects of climate change, the urgency to do something. And, you know, we really haven't seen a lot of movement. You know, in the case of Greta Thunberg, you know, it'll be interesting to see if this moves the needle at all in terms of, you know, pushing for action, right? So we have, in her case, it's a young woman, a 16-year-old woman. Is that enough to, you know, engage a younger population? Are we going to see action? I think, again, for those who are actively involved in the political process, for those who are actively involved in the policy process, you know, not to be too cynical, but I think a lot of people have probably made up their minds on climate change and the extent to which we should, and the urgency we should address the issue of climate change. It may lead to some action, but I don't know that you're going to see a significant change worldwide based on her statements. And that's not to say that her statements weren't very, very passionate statements. It's just we've also seen a number of reports. Now, things may change because it's a face, it's an identifiable individual, and we've seen in the past where that can move attitudes on particular policies. But we've also had a number of reports that have talked about, like I said, the horrible long-term effects of climate change. We really haven't seen a lot of movement.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, let me ask you it this way. Could Greta Thunberg be the Rachel Carson of our era? Rachel Carson from the early 1970s,
yeah.
Silent Spring, we remember that. Her warning of pesticides and was a turning point that it was embodied in Rachel Carson, right?
Yeah, and you know, movements need effective spokespeople who can really captivate public attention and draw, you know, draw people into that agenda. And certainly, she is a very compelling young woman. And so she's driving a lot of attention. And I think in part that's because she represents so much of what the environmental movement today kind of symbolizes. A, you know, this globalism and the understanding that the problem reaches across boundaries. Combine that with the effectiveness of social media and a new way to communicate across boundaries. You know, a lot of energy and youth, right? And just the fact that you have someone who at 16 years old is able to drive a narrative in the way that she has been, I think is pretty remarkable. And so many young people are coming forward in the political environment and saying, you know, look, this is about us, right? This is the world that we have to live in. And so I think she's, you know, she's really kind of driving something here. Having said that, I tend to agree with Chris. I think over the long term, this is a giant ship to try to turn around, right? This is an absolutely remarkable, remarkably difficult feat that she's trying to pull off. And so I'm, you know, in the same way that I think many other young people get a lot of attention early on because they enter into politics with these very urgent pleas. There's so much of this that really does require a level of organization and dedication and long-term coordination. And right now, we have great environmental groups, but we also have incredible organization stopping some of those changes that need to be made.
Mm-hmm. Greta Thunberg getting the attention of our president as well. He retweeted footage of her speech and widely seen as mocking her by saying, "She seems like a very happy young girl looking forward to a bright and wonderful future. So nice to see." Thunberg responded, the 16-year-old responded by changing her Twitter biography to "a very happy young girl looking forward to a bright and wonderful future." So not what one would expect from a 16-year-old, but there you go. Let's get on to a couple of other things before this hour gets away from us. Let's talk about the Iowa poll released a few days ago. For the first time, it's someone other than Joe Biden at the top of the Iowa poll, Elizabeth Warren. Surging, narrowly overtaking Biden, distancing herself from the fellow progressive Bernie Sanders. That's according to the latest Des Moines Register, CNN, Mediacom, Iowa poll. Warren now a 2 percentage point lead with 22% of Democratic caucus scores saying she is their first choice for president. Former Vice President Biden, who, by the way, led the Register's three previous 2020 cycle polls, follows her at 20%. Sanders dropping back to third place, 11%. No other candidate reaching double digits. What do you see? We should mention here the polling for Warren going well in New Hampshire. Also, I see this morning California also as well. Chris Larimer, what do you see happening with the Warren surge here in the polls?
Well, you know, some of it could be that folks are just you know, moving away from Biden. I think, you know, one of the interesting findings in the poll is that 63% said they could still be persuaded within the Iowa poll anyway. I think, you know, anytime you have these poll results, you also have to be careful about, you know, what we call non-response bias. Is this the case of Biden supporters not really being as willing to answer a survey if they're not feeling all that great about their candidate at the moment? And so is that driving some of this shift? But I think, you know, generally, you know, that we're seeing this across the board, that we're seeing that it's Warren and Biden are essentially in statistical ties, as you mentioned, in Nevada, California, New Hampshire, Iowa. It's interesting to see the Sanders supporters or the support for Sanders dropping off considerably in a number of these polls. And so is it the case that Sanders supporters are just now moving on to Warren? And, you know, in the case of the Iowa poll, it's also interesting, you know, initially it wasn't that long ago that we thought of this as sort of a two-tier race where you had Biden, Warren, and Sanders, and then kind of Booker, Harris, and Buttigieg. And now if you look at the Iowa poll, it's, you know, Warren, Biden, as you said, at 22 and 20%, and then Sanders at 11%. no one else is in double digits. You have Kamala Harris at 6% and Pete Buttigieg at 9%.
Kamala Harris, even in her home state of California, in single digits. Interesting.
Right.
Rachel, we're running out of time. Sorry to cut you off, Chris, but let's get Rachel in on these latest polls and what you're seeing in them, Rachel.
Yeah, I would first of all reiterate something that Chris said, which is this is a statistical tie. There's a lot of media attention being given to the fact that Warren has pulled ahead, and they're stating it as definitive fact. And the margin of error on these polls is such that essentially it's impossible to know who's ahead between Warren and Biden. So I want to urge a little bit of caution on that front.
Okay, but what? Okay, something's moving. We can think by these. So how about this question? What is the appeal of Warren to Iowans, caucus goers, and those in New Hampshire, Nevada, California? What seems to be going on in your opinion, Rachel?
Well, I think first of all, one of the things that I do see consistently is a decline in support for Sanders. And I think that's a particularly interesting piece of it because I think it demonstrates what's changing within the party as a whole. So much of what made Sanders so popular in 2016, he's been successful at changing the agenda of the Democratic Party. And so many of the candidates today are adopting similar ideas that I think he's finding a hard time gaining traction in the same way. Mm-hmm. I'm also interested in the fact that Buttigieg is doing considerably better in the early states than he is nationwide. And he seems to be kind of pulling in pretty consistently to that top four or five candidates. Given that he's really new on the national political scene, I think is pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you both before we go away in a couple minutes. I don't know if you, last weekend we had so many events. We had the steak fry in Polk County. We had an LGBTQ forum in Cedar Rapids. I don't know if either of you have, Chris, a comment on either of those. I don't know if you've been out attending any of these events.
No, I have not been able to attend either event.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what about you? What did you take in terms of that Polk County steak fry? What a tradition. I understand it was the largest event in that history of the steak fry, more than 12,000 Democrats to the Waterworks Park.
More than 12,000 people in that park. It was packed. It was a lot of fun. There was a lot
there.
Of energy and excitement. I was there.
17 presidential candidates.
17 presidential candidates, wow. Including a few in the pouring rain at the end of the day. it was an experience. And all weekend, there were a bunch of other forums as well. CCI put on the People's Presidential Forum. There was a Youth Voice Forum at the Roosevelt High School put on by the student body at Roosevelt. And so there, just across the board, it was kind of wall-to-wall candidate events going on this weekend. It was a lot of fun to see them. I have to say, at the steak fry itself, Warren and Buttigieg very clearly had had invested in their presence at the steak fry, Well, you could see the T-shirts and the sign up and the staff and the volunteers and the marching and the right, all the things that are kind of a hallmark of some of these big campaign events in Iowa, and they're meant to signal very clearly the organizational aspects of the campaign, right? How are they doing at actually pulling people in and exciting their supporters, which, unlike so many states, is really the key to the Iowa caucuses. And so I think both campaigns put on a great show just in terms of the level of support that they have. It was interesting at the end. A lot of campaigns did this. I think Warren and Buttigieg were just the most visible. I was listening to two campaign staffers on different campaigns talk to each other towards the end of the day, and they were congratulating each other on their excellent work astroturfing this event.
Astroturfing.
Yeah.
That involves actually laying down astroturf.
If you think about what's important in organization, it's grassroots, right?
Oh,
so astroturfing refers to fake grassroots, to making it seem as though you have this grassroots support in politics.
That flew by me the first time. Thank you for pointing it out. That's
and
a
I
good
did
term.
Hear, I did hear from a number of people. I talked to a number of people at the steak fry who were not from Iowa, who had come in to work with the campaigns, and just to attend with their campaigns. So it's kind of interesting just to be at an event event like that, look at all that people power and realize that while some of it is legitimate, some of it is very carefully created, and it's very image based.
It very much is. I'm going to be stepping out of the studio and walking down the hall saying astroturfing to myself for the rest of the day, I think. Mm-hmm. What a great term.
Yeah.
Great in terms of explaining what's going on. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in our Cedar Falls studio. Thanks to both of you for coming in. And the story to be continued, as always, in politics. What an exciting time. Thank you, mm-hmm. Rachel. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
If you missed part of this program, you can always check out our podcast. Go to iowapublicradio.org, and you'll be able to download this hour in a short amount of time. River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Help today also from Stephanie Nobrega. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks to the callers and everyone who weighed in today. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.